Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Today's episode is brought to you by Pluto TV. Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. You can watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. No credit card needed. No sign up. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again. Download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today.
Hello and welcome into a very special edition of Beyond the Darkness. I'm Tim Dennis, in for Dave Schrader. Folks, normally this is where we do our Supernatural News and Parashare edition of Beyond the Darkness on a Saturday. Unfortunately, as you heard during the week this week, we had some very sad news. A good friend of the show, a good friend to the paranormal community, and a good friend to ufology. Stanton Friedman passed away this week at the age of 84 years old. If you don't know who Stanton Friedman is, I think you've been living under a rock or you're brand new to the paranormal, one or the other. Stanton Friedman, of course, credited with bringing Roswell to the mainstream conversation in the whole Roswell incident. Stanton was born in Fredericton and was quite the mover and shaker in the UFO field. He was one who put it front and center and I think made ufology more believable for even the hardcore skeptics out there in ufology. He was returning from a speaking engagement in Columbus, Ohio, when he passed away suddenly at the Toronto Pearson Airport on Monday night. Unfortunately, that was a tragic, tragic incident. Stanton was a nuclear physicist by training. Friedman had devoted his life to researching and investigating UFOs since the late 1960s. Stanton also was credited with bringing the 1947 Roswell incident to the conversation, the mainstream conversation of UFOs in the United States. He also brought up the theories of a U.S. military cover-up to the mainstream conversation as well. Now, Stanton had officially retired last year, but he still booked some speaking engagements because he really did love talking UFOs. He loved getting out and meeting everybody, including you guys, you folks who are listening right now in the audience. He was just one of those guys who took an extra moment or two at conventions to get to know you and to talk UFOs with you, and he loved doing it. He never really truly retired, even to the point where, you know, when he wanted to be honored, he got that smile on his face, and he did get inducted into the UFO Hall of Fame in Roswell, New Mexico, which was a great day, not only for Stanton, but a great day for all of us as well. Stanton, you're definitely one who's going to be missed in the field. And I, earlier in the week, when I was doing Midnight in the Desert, had a short conversation before the show with Michelle, one of the producers, and we were trying to think of how exactly you would fill the void left by Stanton Friedman. And, you know, we were talking about up-and-comers in the field who could potentially fill that void, who had the scientific knowledge, but yet would still have a bit of a skeptical eye. And I came up with Micah Hanks, but after Micah, there aren't, even after Micah, there was Joshua P. Warren, the other name that came to mind. But after those two brilliant minds, you know, I suppose I should throw Josh Gates in there, too. So you've got those three brilliant minds as far as the younger generation, the newer generation. And after that, I mean, the list is short as far as who steps into the shoes of Stanton Friedman. It really is sad. It's sad that some of our greatest ufologists are passing away. Ken Gerhardt is another one who could step in and cover some of that. Nick Redfern, of course, and Nick Pope, are out there as well. But it's sad. Stanton Friedman, of course, passing away Monday at the age of 84. He's survived by his wife of 44 years, Marilyn, the mother to Melissa Friedman. He also had three children from a previous marriage. We're going to miss you, Stanton. And in honor of Stanton this Saturday, and of course tomorrow, we're going to do two interviews that Stanton had granted us throughout the history of not only Beyond the Darkness, but Darkness Radio. This one was one that he granted to us back in 2016. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Here is Stanton Friedman here in tribute to him on Beyond the Darkness.
Good evening and welcome. You're tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. Darkness Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Tonight, beginning the show this evening, though, we're going to discuss UFOs. There's a brand new book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, The Truth Behind the Misinformation, Distortion, and Derision by Debunkers, Government Agencies, and Conspiracy Con Men. Joining us back on the show this evening, one of our favorite guests is here with us. Stanton Friedman is here, and joining him, Kathleen Marden. It's great to have you both with us. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Delighted to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. I think, Stanton, this marks our ninth year of working with you on the show, and it's always a pleasure to have you join us. And I think, Kathleen, we've had you pop in with us, I think, once or twice over the year as well, so it's great to have you back in.
Thanks.
Brand new book. It's out and available right now. Okay. All right. Good. And we'll put up links to the website so you can find ways to pick that up. You can always check out stantonfriedman.com, kathleen-marden.com. Here we are, 2016. Every week there seems to be some more news that's actually making it to the main news sources of something being sighted in the skies in very peculiar places, nuclear facilities over restricted airspace, things that just don't belong where they're being seen. Yet there's still this misinformation being given. There's still this ignoring what's taking place. And I'm not quite sure what's going on. Stanton, I know that you've been involved in this field for a long time. Why are we still at a point in 2016 that the government needs to feel the, reason to hide this information from us?
Well, it's not only the government, but the media has a role in this, and the astronomical and SETI community. It's a strange situation. We have more awareness, I think, now than ever before, that there are planets all over the place out there. There were people who would say 60 years ago, that our solar system's the only solar system. So what are you talking about visitors? Ain't nobody out there.
Right.
'Cause there's no place for them to be. And now... to give you a number to work around, the latest estimates based on the Kepler spacecraft, which is a very precise device that is in orbit and spots planets going in front of their stars and can tell the difference in the light coming from the star, which is quite remarkable. Anyway, the upshot is that now we assume, we deduce from the data, that there's between 1 and 1.6 planets per star. In other words, some stars would have 10 planets, or 8, or 2, or none. But there's a lot of planets out there. What that means is, to bring it home to our local neighborhood, within 100 light years of here, there are approximately 10,000 stars, which means something over 10,000 planets. And yet, Frank Drake of the SETI community, astronomer, years ago said there might be as many as 10,000 places in the galaxy that could be sending us messages. A better number now might be 10 billion or 100 billion, because there's about 100 to 200 billion. Nobody's counted them all, obviously, stars in the galaxy. So to go from being alone, just us, or maybe there are 10,000 out there in the galaxy, which is 100,000 light years across. Now we're saying, hey, there's at least 10,000 planets within 100 light years, just down the street, local neighborhood. And so there are the general acceptance of that idea that there's other life out there, we can't be alone, is pretty good. The kicker is that the SETI and astronomical communities keep insisting, ain't nobody coming here. If they were, they'd want to talk to us, I guess, right. is the idea. And so there's a lot of talk, and it's not pejorative, in other words, about the idea that there's other life out there, but it's always from the viewpoint, we're waiting for a signal. They're going to send us a signal. We just got to wait long enough. Now, why they would use technology appropriate to us, who's only had long-distance radio since 1901, I don't know. But there's a great deal of misinformation. That was one of the reasons for the book. Kathy has spent a lot of time at archives, as I have, and we keep finding documents that tell us a very different story when you start pursuing the truth than what we hear from the nasty, noisy negativists. I think you were surprised a little, Kathy, weren't you, the first time around?
I was, because I was went to the American Philosophical Society to fill up Klass's archival collection, primarily because he had given my aunt, Betty Hill, a really rough time over most of her lifetime after the story of her abduction and my uncle's abduction was released as the result of a violation of confidentiality. And he really picked up on his harassment and his disinformation after Barney died, and then again after the movie UFO Incident aired on network television in 1975. I wanted to know if I could find any evidence that he was working for a government agency. I wanted to look at his correspondence and find out if he had communicated with individuals such as Dr. Donald Menzel, the astrophysicist from Harvard University. Stanton had gone to Harvard and had discovered in Menzel's files that he had worked for the NSA. So that was a very interesting find. I spent many, many hours at the APS. I made several trips there over many days. And I came home with a wealth of information that I didn't dream even existed, not only about my aunt and uncle's case, but about every single compelling UFO sighting case where there was physical evidence, and case that was pretty compelling with regard to a UFO abduction. And Klass was in there with a team of others doing their best to disseminate false information about that case and to attack individuals. And also, it wasn't limited only to the individuals who experienced this, but to the scientists who were studying this, to the credible individuals who were speaking publicly about this. And I found the more credible the individual, the more ruthlessly Philip Klass went after them. For example, there was Dr. James McDonald, and we can see that he was really a thorn in the side of Philip Klass and also of Edward Condon and Donald Menzel and others who were opposed to the scientific study of UFOs. We found information about their attempts to not only destroy McDonald's credibility, but also to destroy him as a professional. The lengths that they went to do this are just amazing. In fact, I found...
Could I ask real quickly, Kathleen, when you look at that, to go to this level to discredit it, do you believe that it was because they were trying to keep a secret, or do they vehemently believe that we're not making contact, that these things are not real?
I think that they were attempting to keep a secret. I think that is particularly true of Donald Menzel. Philip Klass might have known the truth. He certainly, I have examples where he did know the truth about certain information and lied about it anyway. With the story of Dr. McDonald, Class actually sent disinformation to Jack Anderson at the Washington Post in 1968 and saying that McDonald was misusing naval research funds for his cloud studies because he was using the funding to research UFOs in Australia. The truth was that he was investigating UFO reports in Australia in his spare time, not with Office of Naval Research funding. But Jack Anderson published the story given to him by Class. Class then took that story, his name was not mentioned in the article, and sent a letter to the Office of Naval Research stating, quote, "The shocking misuse of naval research funds cited in the enclosed article is not only true, but was condoned, if not encouraged, by the Office of Naval Research Contract Monitor." Well, there was an investigation that ensued. McDonald was found innocent. He had not misused naval research funds. Yet, because of Class's threats, his funding was revoked. And this happened on two different occasions in funding that he was receiving. So it was really destructive to his professional career. And he was at the top of his game as a meteorological physicist, highly esteemed in his field. And this is just one example of the kind of treatment those who were supporters of and proponents of the scientific study of UFOs, the kind of treatment they received.
Kathleen, in the last segment, we were talking about the fact that they'll go to these extreme lengths in order to discredit somebody, and they're not necessarily discrediting the research. What they do is, it seemed in his case, they were discrediting how he was going about doing it, so that it just, even though he wasn't really doing it on military time or money, he wasn't doing anything wrong, suddenly the funding isn't there because he's just kind of got this weird stigma attached to him. Is that kind of what they go for? If they can't beat you, they'll just take your legs out from under you?
Well, and not only that case, we talk about how J. Allen Hynek, head of the astronomy department at Northwestern University, Air Force scientific consultant to Project Blue Book for almost 20 years, that Phil wrote a vicious letter to the FBI about him because they had published a very nice article by Hynek in the Law Enforcement Journal, and he was attacking Hynek, he's not a scientist, and on and on. And
he called him the spiritual leader of a vocal group of believers and kooks who claimed they were being visited by extraterrestrial spaceships.
That's pretty bad. And when the FBI, to its credit, told him that Hynek had a fine reputation amongst professionals. And they also pointed out, if you get his FBI file, which is available, go to the Internet, you find out that they wanted to persecute Class twice for releasing classified information, but they didn't have approval to declassify the information so that they could push it. So they did not have good things to say about Mr. Class, but if he didn't get the FBI file, you wouldn't know that, or get our book, I guess.
It's all in the book as well.
And but here you've got, if I could ask, you've got FBI kind of standing up for the reputation of Hynek, and then you've got another guy trying to devalue him. I mean, is it that these different alphabet agencies are not working in conjunction with one another? It seems like they would know about something in this grand scale that it's UFO related, not just ours. Why are they undermining each other?
Well, they don't seem to be. I was surprised to see the strong defense that the FBI made of Hynek, and clear indication that they didn't trust Class as far as they could throw him. And so, you know, we did find connection between Dr. Edward Condon, but he was head of an Air Force study, professor of physics, outstanding reputation as a physicist, but who said some really stupid things in his report, including, Kathy, do you have the exact quotation on that? Nobody would be coming here for 10,000 years?
Yeah, as I haven't entirely memorized it, and I don't have the Condon report in front of me.
No,
but he made the statement that There was no reason to believe that intelligent life from elsewhere would be coming to, I'm not sure if it was the solar system or planet Earth, for at least 10,000 years. And it was apparently based upon some kind of mathematical model that was obviously incorrect, since there's ample evidence to those who have studied this and have really taken a serious scientific look at the evidence that we are being visited.
Yeah, it's one of the weird things. I mean, I could understand. I can forgive Donald Menzel, if I can put it that way. I didn't like him while he was alive. I had one run-in with him, which was certainly didn't give me a good feeling about him as a scientist. I was speaking at Harvard. I called. I got on campus early to ask him, to invite him, really, to my lecture, because I didn't know how much promotion had been done. It was an engineering alumni group. And I gave him my name. Oh, I know all about you. And I didn't find out until Kathy saw the copies of letters from Condon to Menzel at the APS files. But my comment was, oh, you read my congressional testimony next to yours. And his next letter, next comment was a classic. You can't be a scientist and believe in flying saucers. At which I laughed. What else am I going to do with a stupid statement like that?
Right.
Anyway, he got angry. And I said, Dr. Menzel, I didn't call to engage with you. I called out of courtesy to invite you to my lecture tonight at 8 o'clock at such and such a building. Oh, well, of course I won't be there. So a conversation like that doesn't lead you to believe the guy's being scientific. So it was totally shocking when we got the MJ-12 documents, some of which are genuine, most of which are not, and I don't care about those. And it lists Menzel as being one of 12 people put into business on Operation Majestic 12 by President Truman after Roswell several months.
Hmm.
And the other guys, the other 11, all made sense, five civilian, five military, six military and six civilian, really. You know, what the heck is Menzel doing? This must be a joke. We certainly weren't going to go public with that without having verified stuff. Well, I found Menzel's name in an article about loyalty hearings. He thanked Dr. Vannevar Bush, who was basically Truman's scientific advisor. And here's this letter to Bush thanking him for all his work in clearing Menzel from disloyalty charges and help making it possible for him to keep his security clearance. This is from a lawyer, big law firm in Boston. 1950. What the heck was this all about?
Right.
I called the lawyer, and he said, oh, yeah, there's 1,000 pages of the hearings and stuff in his Harvard files. That's what led me to the files. And first I checked the New York Times and the Washington Post, and there wasn't anything. That seems strange. You may not be old enough to know, but there was a communist under every bed was the attitude of some people back at that time.
Right.
So you would have expected the Times and the Post to carry it. Anyway, I called the Harvard Archives and found out that, indeed, they had a big file on Menzel. He was deceased, as were all the other members, so you couldn't talk to any of them. And I found out, well, I'd like to see them. Well, you're going to need permission, and three different people. I had to get written permission to view Menzel's papers. Well, I did that. It took a little while. And then I got a grant from the Fund for UFO Research and went up to Harvard, not knowing what I was looking for, because I knew some of his UFO stuff was at the place that Kathy had found it. And there was a file, John F. Kennedy. Oh, that's interesting. So I opened that and was totally shocked by a letter from Menzel. It was clear they knew each other on a first-name basis. They even, I found out later, even had breakfast together on occasion, two Bostonians, you might say. And a letter from Menzel to Kennedy, saying after he had been elected president that there's one area where I may be of assistance to you. I have a longer continuous association with the National Security Agency of anybody, 30 years. When we are properly cleared to each other, I can tell you more. wow, where'd that come from?
Right.
You know, NSA is Mr. Snowden's agency. You know,
right.
Never says anything, no such agency, those guys. Well, it turns out, in reading more, it turns out Menzel was also a world-class cryptologist, code breaker, code maker. And as a matter of fact, there was a paper in Scientific Journal about 6 years ago about the cryptologic contributions of Donald Menzel. Now, as an indication of how classified, how hidden this information was, the Sky and Telescope, great astronomy magazine, had two issues dedicated to Menzel, one on the occasion of his death and the other on his 100th anniversary of his birth. They went on at quite great length, but neither one of them mentioned anything about all this post-World War II highly classified work of Menzel. There were people at Harvard, when I talked to, I don't believe that was kind of the attitude, you know. And so that was shocking, but it proved the necessity for getting first-hand information. Not A said, B said, C said, but here's what A wrote. Here's what B wrote. And so that's one of the reasons for us writing this book, is to make clear to people that you really have to dig deeply, because governments and nasty people, not always one and the same thing, go to great efforts to dissuade us from certain notions, ufology being certainly one of them. So they're not the only guys, but they're the three big names. And let me give you an example from class, the kind of so-called research that he did.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned MJ-12, Majestic 12. One of the documents that was found at the National Archives was just a half-page memo, the Cutler-Twining memo. Bobby Cutler was Ike's national security advisor. General Twining was an Air Force general who went on to be chief of staff of the Air Force, mind you. And it's just a little memo saying that the NSC MJ-12 Special Studies Project review will take place at this time instead of at that time. I mean, Twining was busy. You got to tell your generals, hey, the meeting's been switched. Well, that really got me rolling,
right,
on the Cutler and Twining memo. And when there was noise about it, there was a you and a cry that can't be genuine. And, of course, the biggest noise came from class. And he challenged me. Maybe you didn't notice that it was done in the large pica type. Of course I had. I've spent many days at the Eisenhower Library, as it turned out, and that's part of the story. He never even went there, but he claimed the NSC uses only elite type, not pica type, and he sent nine documents to prove it. I challenge you, he said very strongly and vociferously, to find any genuine letters, memos, etc., in the NSC papers done in the same size and style type. And I'll give you $100 each for every genuine one, up to a maximum of 10, unfortunately. Well, I was going to the Eisenhower Library. I went there. It's easy. I first went to my files. I found 20 documents done in pica type, so I know I, you know, wasn't crazy. I went to the library, copied out 14 that were done the same size and style type, and met other criteria that he had. Sent him copies and an invoice for $1,000, and he paid me.
Wow.
He told everybody about challenging me, nobody about paying me, and got very angry when I included a copy of his check in the book, and it's in this book, too. And it says, his writing, MJ-12 research on the bottom.
All right, we need to take another quick break. Fact, fiction, and flying saucers, that's the topic these first 2 hours. Kathleen Martin and Stanton Friedman are guests. And remember, you can always check our website for updates, information, and more. You can find ways to communicate, connect, and find the projects that all of our guests are working on. Visit darknessradio.com and click on the guest tab for more information. We'll be right back.
Every car comes with its share of stories. That ding in your bumper when you nervously picked up a first date, the luxury package you got after a big promotion, or the mileage you saved by riding your bike all summer. While you can't put a price tag on your stories, now with TrueCar, you can at least find out what your car's worth is when it comes time to sell or trade it in. Just go to TrueCar. Simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Then answer a few questions. Navigation and moonroof? Watch as they bump up your value. High mileage? You already knew it was going to cost you, but now you know how much it dings your wallet so you can plan ahead. Once you've finished, you'll get a true cash offer sent in minutes, which you can take to a local certified dealer to cash out or trade in. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. True cash offer not available in all areas.
All right, we're back here on Darkness Radio. So you've got some of these great minds that are under attack, that are being undermined, disinformation, misinformation being given. But Kathleen, you've got information on another leading scientist and researcher who was being targeted and mercilessly. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, and his name is Stanton Friedman.
I've heard of that guy. He's good.
In 1980, Stan and his family were moving to New Brunswick, Canada from California. His wife's family lived there, and they thought it would be nice to be near the family. And Philip Klass got wind of it, and he ended up writing a letter to A.G. McNamara, Dr. McNamara, at the Hertzberg Institute of Astrophysics, the National Research Council in Ottawa, Canada. And in that letter, he stated that he regretted that he had to bring, quote, bad tidings in regard to their UFO responsibilities. And he added that a ufologist, noted ufologist, full-time UFO lecturer, quote, of the snake oil salesman variety, will soon move up to Canada to become its chief UFO guru. And he also stated that Stan's lectures are very colorful, and he's quite a showman, unlike Hynek, whose lectures are rather dull, he said. He said his one-hour lecture is so filled with half-truths and falsehoods that it would take me several hours to offer a rebuttal. And like wrestling with an octopus, when you manage to pin down one leg, the other seven are still thrashing about. Stan had no idea that Klass had ever written that letter. But steps were taken. Apparently, they thought that this was an official letter. It sounded very official,
right?
Written by Philip Klass. And the archives were expunged of identifying information, including people's names and their addresses. And therefore, anyone who wanted to go there to do the research would not be able to contact the reporter, the person who made the report. So Klass was successful, I think, in his attempt to ruin Stanton Friedman's research in Canada and to give him a bad name, too. Obviously, Klass was lying. Stanton is a highly credible scientist, a nuclear physicist, a meticulous researcher. But this is the kind of thing that Philip Klass did in order to see that the scientific study of UFOs could not be carried out.
Well, he's good, but he's no rocket scientist. Oh, wait. Yeah, I guess he kind of is, isn't he?
I am, yeah. I worked on nuclear rockets and space programs and stuff like that.
That's my point. I always think it's fascinating. You know, it's great when you can have people that come together that have this kind of insight, understanding, and that it's, you know, I love the listeners of the show and followers and people that are into the paranormal, ufology, all of this, but have these deep-rooted theories and beliefs, and, you know, they work at Menards cutting lumber, but they know about jet propulsion, they know this, and then you have somebody like Stanton Friedman who comes forward and legitimately knows these things and understands how craft should work and should not work and understands how we should be able to make these communications. So it's I love when there's some kind of accredited person that we're able to speak to regarding these type of conspiracies. It's so strange to me, as I said at the beginning of the show, that in 2016 this is even still an issue. I don't understand And Kathleen, you brought it up earlier, right? I mean, they're saying, oh, it's going to be at least 10,000 years. Well, what about the UFOs over Washington? What about Roswell? What about Rendlesham? What about Betty and Barney Hill? What about Betty Andreessen? I mean, these are some amazing stories and cases that you can't just sweep under. I mean, the UFOs, and correct me if I'm wrong, unless I've missed something along the way here. Everybody always says if there's really UFOs, why don't they land on the White House yard? Stanton, they did film photographs of UFOs flying over Washington, D.C. in the 1950s.
Yeah. Multiple witness radar visual cases. And the Air Force had, in 1952, late July, the largest press conference they'd had since the end of the war, where General Samford, how shall I put it, identified the unidentifieds, you know, in effect saying there's really nothing to it, folks. Don't worry about it. On the other hand, later that year, we know that the Air Force put out a regulation that flying saucers, so-called, should be shot down if they don't land when instructed to do so. Now, don't ask me how a pilot tells the saucer, hey, get your butt on the ground, buddy, or I'm going to shoot you.
Right.
But, and there were General Roger Ramey, who was involved in the Roswell incident and had been head of the 8th Air Force, stated that, oh, well, we've scrambled more than 300 times, but it's just routine. So they were, on the one hand, taking it very seriously, but on the other hand, not publicly. And Kathy found some very interesting sessions with the Air Force where Menzel was trying to convince them that he had the answer to everything. And Kathy, he didn't, did he?
He didn't. In fact, this was in May of 1952. He had a meeting at the Pentagon with five military officers and a secretary who was doing the recording. And what he said is that he had solved the Air Force's UFO problem through a few elementary experiments using liquids of different densities. But the Air Force wasn't buying it. Dr. Stephen Posenay, who was the director of intelligence under a special study group under Major General John Samford, stated that to Menzel, well, why do you think that your few simple elementary experiments prove anything? And Menzel didn't like that very well. He kind of changed the subject, and he said to the military officers, well, you know, most reports are hoaxes anyway. And the military spoke up, and they said, no, you're incorrect. Only 2% of the cases in our files are considered to be hoaxes. And so Menzel then said, well, I want your endorsement, because I've written two articles, one in Time magazine and one in Look magazine. And he was using his theories, you might say, to dismiss all UFOs as being something else, atmospheric phenomena or something else. And General Garland spoke up and refused to blindly endorse Menzel's few simple theories. Well, Menzel blew his stack, but before he left, he volunteered to become an unpaid consultant to Project Blue Book. His initial request was denied. But we find by 1965, by the mid-1960s, he is working as an unpaid consultant to Project Blue Book under Hector Quintanilla, and so was Philip Klass. Pretty amazing.
And unbelievable.
Yes, it is unbelievable. That was one of the reasons for publishing this book, is that there's a lot of stuff that we weren't the only people who knew, but that were not generally known, that have to be put out in public for the world to see. And with Menzel, at least it goes with the combination of finding out that he worked for the government, NSA and other agencies. And so he was talking out of one side of his mouth over here, but he never told anybody about his involvement with the government. We think the public needs to know this. And it's the same with Condon. I mean, yes, an outstanding scientist. I, as a physicist, greatly appreciate the fact that he was president of the American Physical Society, head of the one big scientific organization, But when he spoke about UFOs, he didn't know what the heck he was talking about. As an example, not only that comment about 10,000 years before anybody visits us, but the press coverage when the study came out indicated that only a few percent of the cases couldn't be identified. But the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, of which I am still a member, had a UFO subcommittee that reviewed the Condon report, and they put out a statement in a journal, scientific journal, saying that one could come to the opposite conclusions from Dr. Condon's. Any phenomena with 30% unexplained is certainly worthy of further scientific investigation. You didn't see that in the press much.
No. You've got all this weird covert action taking place. People helping and wanting to research, people debunking and giving disinformation, misinformation, people making bold claims that, you know, if UFOs were real, they would have contacted us and alien races would have targeted us already. Yet we have the WOW signal. We have UFOs over Washington. We have nuclear vessels out in the ocean that are continually plagued by these strange craft. And yet this constant wave of denial continues. And I don't know if one of you can remember which president it was, but I think it might have been Eisenhower, who during a press conference said, yes, we're well aware and we have things handled with the UFO or the flying saucers. So he seems to boldly just admit it in a public way that, yes, we're aware of it and we're doing stuff about it. And that's about it. Not a denial of there is no flying saucers, but we're aware of it and we're working on it. Which president was that? Was that Eisenhower?
I don't remember him saying that specifically, but it might well have been because he was very close to the truth in most of his public statements. He was very careful. He had need to know for everything. He knew what you couldn't declassify. But there's an important point that needs to be brought into here. The public and the media bought into the idea that the Air Force group concerned with UFOs, the only one for many years, was Project Blue Book, located at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base from the early 50s to the late 60s. And it wasn't until 1979 that we got a copy of the memo from a General Carol Bolander, Air Force General, who was asked in the late 60s to decide or to come up with a plan for what should the Air Force do about Project Blue Book. The Condon people had said, close it. It's not contributing much to science or defense, and I'm not disagreeing with that particularly. We didn't see Bolander's memo, which was obtained by a guy who made loads, Bob Todd was his name, made loads of Freedom of Information Act requests and probably got it by accident, you know, throw that in the pile kind of thing. Anyway, we saw it 10 years later. He wrote it in 69. In 79, we got the memo. And it was astonishing. He said, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with JNAP, Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146, or Air Force Manual 55-11, and are not part of the Blue Book system. That was an incredible statement. Incidentally, Blue Book was closed because of this. And two paragraphs later, he said, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report UFO sightings. However, as already noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the procedures designed for that purpose. Now, I should point out that the Air Force for many, many years before that and after that was saying Blue Book was it. It's the only thing going on, and there is no national security aspect to any of this. Well, I got upset, and I thought, I've got to talk to General Bolander. I'm glad his name wasn't John Smith, because I'm better at finding Bolanders than Smiths. And I managed to locate him and called him and told him, you know, I'd worked under security for 14 years. I was very interested in this memo. We were interested in UFOs. I said, it seems to me as though you're saying there are two separate communication channels for UFO sighting reports. One for the national security ones, like one I got just a couple of weeks before I talked to him, which a guy told me about a saucer going down the runway at a Strategic Air Command base where nuclear weapons were stored. And I said, seems to me that would automatically be a problem for national security. And the other, if my wife and I are driving down the street and see a saucer fly by, big deal, happens all the time. No emphasis on that. And he agreed with me. Two separate communication channels. And that was such an astonishing statement that we didn't know about. I mean, it was written in 69, we found out in 79, and I think our book has done more to cover Bolinder's statement than anybody else's. And it raises a question, obviously. So wait a minute now. Where did the sightings that could affect national security go if they didn't go to Project Blue Book? Not a trivial question. And the kind of, when we say national security, the guys with the best equipment for monitoring UFO flyovers are the government, because they got ground radar, they got air radar, they got satellite spies. You know, Kathy and I don't have our own radar sets for checking on UFO sightings. You know.
With regard to your question, though, about a statement by Eisenhower, I wasn't able to find that anywhere, but it sounds nearly identical to the statement made by General Samford at that huge press conference at the Pentagon on July 29th, 1952, where he did acknowledge that people were saying this. He said, "We're not trying to discredit the observers. That's the reason that I said we have many reports from credible observers of incredible things." He added, "There's nothing else in the work that can do these things except phenomena." And that word phenomena is something that we found that the Air Force pushed. And then the CIA, as the result of the Robertson panel, because phenomena is something that is observable, but it's not really something that can be studied scientifically. So I think there was a little bit of a trick in there with the use of phenomena. They wanted UFOs to be looked at in the same terms as the Foo Fighters from World War II.
Right, something that was existing, but they didn't want to give it a precise title. We'll come back. We've got more fact, fiction, and flying saucers in the next hour here on Darkness Radio.
If you like our show, you're going to love AJ Benza, Fame as a Bitch, on Podcast One. Join the gossip columnist as he gives his unfiltered opinion on the biggest scandals with his insider perspective on the lives of who's who in Hollywood and tough guy demeanor. Download new episodes of Fame as a Bitch every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Beyond the darkness.
We hope you've been enjoying this encore presentation of Darkness Radio, Beyond the Darkness, from 2016. Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers with Kathleen Martin and the late Stanton Friedman. This is our tribute episode, one of two this weekend, to the late Stanton Friedman, who passed away at the age of 84. This past week. Of course, Stanton Friedman being one of the great ufologists in the field of the paranormal, we just want to show our respects this weekend to Stanton Friedman in any way possible. Stanton, of course, being one of our favorite guests here on Beyond the Darkness. Not just one of our favorite guests, but one of our favorite all-time people to hang out with, one of our all-time favorite friends to hang out with in the paranormal at different conventions and running into Stanton at the different conventions around the country was truly a pleasure. Truly a pleasure to see Stanton. If you've had the pleasure of meeting Stanton at any of the conventions, the variety of ties he wore to conventions were truly colorful and cool to look at, among other things. His smile was just a great smile to see. And his passion for the field was truly something to see as well. It was, Stanton was a hell of a guy. That's just the only way to put it. And, you love seeing somebody who has a passion for their work. talk about their work, and be able to talk with Stanton was a gift. It truly was a gift, and a gift that we're all a little sadder for not having around anymore. Stanton, we'll miss you. We'll miss you quite a bit. And but we have your gift in recordings like the one that we're continuing to listen to today. And we have your gift in books, the books that you've left behind, in the video that you've left behind, and the documentation you've left behind. So let's continue without further ado. Here's the second half of Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. Kathleen Marden, his co-author on the book, and the late, great Stanton Friedman here on Beyond the Darkness.
Welcome back to the show. This is Darkness Radio, the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis, joining us for this next hour, Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Marden, the authors of Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. Stanton, a longtime guest of our show, is a nuclear physicist, lecturer, received his BSc and MSc degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 55 and 56. He was employed for 14 years as a nuclear physicist by such companies as GE, GM, Westinghouse, TRW Systems, Aerojet General, and McDonnell Douglas, working in such highly advanced classified, eventually canceled programs as nuclear aircraft, fission and fusion rockets, and various compact nuclear power plants for space and terrestrial applications. He's been with us and has spoken on numerous occasions regarding UFOs and the study and history of aliens. Also joining us, Kathleen Marden, a leading UFO researcher, author, and lecturer, and leading expert on the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience, a MUFON director of experiencer research and foundation for research into extraterrestrial encounters research consultant. She is here with us. And now, you're the niece of Betty and Barney Hill. Is that correct?
That is correct.
If that was something that always I found challenging. If the government was so apt to try to sweep things under the carpet, how did their story get to such a huge public awareness and they not get taken out of the picture?
Well, there were many attempts made at this. Betty and Barney had made a report to Project Blue Book after their close encounter. And in the original report that they made, they reported a continuous band of lights that they'd observed for 30 to 60 minutes that at that time, at closest approach, it was the size of a nickel at arm's length. Remember that an aspirin will cover the full moon. So it was quite large at closest approach then. But then the report says that it swooped down, and when it was above them, it was as large as a dinner plate at arm's length. So imagine that. It filled up the whole range, the whole field of vision in the windshield of the car. They stated that it had an erratic flight pattern. It ascended and descended swiftly several times. It flew in a jerky motion. They said that when they arrived in the vicinity of Ashland, they again heard the buzzing sound of the object. However, they didn't see it at that time. And Barney stated, inasmuch as he and his wife did in fact see this occurrence, he decided to report it. Well, then only five days later, after taking her first book out of the Portsmouth Public Library on UFOs, Betty sat down and wrote a letter. And in that letter, she described what she saw, and she also described something that Barney saw. And she said, as it glided closer, and this is a quote, he was able to see inside this object, but not too closely. He did see many figures scurrying about as though they were making some hurried type of preparation. One figure was observing us from the windows. From the distance it was seen, the figures appeared to be about the size of a pencil and seemed to be dressed in some type of shiny black uniform. At this point, my husband became shocked and got back in the car in a hysterical condition, laughing and repeating that we were going to be captured. He started driving the car. The motor was left running. As we started to move, we heard several buzzing or beeping sounds that seemed to be striking the trunk of the car. She also told the Air Force about the buzzing or beeping sounds. And then when Walter Webb, an astronomer who was a member of NICAP, went to their house in October of 1961 and interviewed them together and separately for a period of 6 hours, he wrote in his report, and this was a confidential report, the leader at the window had held a special attraction for the witness and frightened him terribly. The witness said he could almost feel this figure's intense concentration to do something, to carry out a plan. Mr. Hill believed that he was about to be captured like a bug in a net. That is when he knew it was no conventional aircraft he was observing, but something alien and unearthly containing beings of a superior type, beings that were somehow not human. And that's a quote. So what we see is that there is a highly credible report made by two credible individuals. They have a great deal of information about the craft being up close, about the buzzing sounds they heard. Barney didn't tell the Air Force about the figures he observed because he was afraid of being ridiculed. But he did tell it to NICAP, to the director of NICAP, Donald Kehoe, and also to Walter Webb. And it's in the earliest archival documents. But then we find that, remember I said in the first Blue Book report, it said that the vehicle ascended and descended rapidly and it swooped down?
Right.
There was a revised Project Blue Book report that came out that lied about it. It said there was no lateral or vertical movement noted. It said there was no evidence presented to indicate the object was due to other than natural causes. Of course, this is a ridiculous explanation when you read the report itself, the initial report that they made. The Air Force concluded, the Project Blue Book, that it was probably an advertising searchlight or the planet Jupiter as a result of a strong temperature inversion. Well, in my investigation, I contacted a veteran meteorologist. He was a senior meteorologist, and asked him to go into the U.S. Weather Service's archival documents. He did, and he asked two of his colleagues to check this out as well to make sure he was accurate. And this is what they wrote. Quote, the light east airflow that night would have caused subsidence warming, just the opposite of an inversion as claimed by the Air Force. So we see a cover-up taking place here. And not only that, there was a cover-up of the radar sightings that that were recorded by the Air Force on their radar at two different stations that night. There was a study done in 1974 by at Maxwell Air Force Base, the Command and Staff College research study, and they wanted to know should the USA Air Force reopen Project Blue Book. And what they stated that was that the official Air Force release concluded by stating there was no evidence presented to indicate the object was due to other natural causes, but makes no mention of the radar tracking. And it said that no attempt was made to visit the reported UFO landing site. No attempt was made at drawing a possible correlation between the visual and radar UFO reports, even though as far back as 1953, Captain Edward Ruppelt stated that visual reports that supposedly correlate with erratic radar tracks warrant a detailed investigation. And there was a bona fide sighting that night. It was not clear why Project Blue Book supposedly withheld information to the press regarding Pease Air Force radar sighting and the radar sighting at the North Concord, Vermont radar station that same night in Vermont. So the Air Force covered it up. They said it was only shimmering on the radar scope. That was not true. There was a radar visual sighting in Vermont. And many, many attempts were made to minimize the conscious continuous recall that Betty and Barney had, to make them look like a couple of kooks, and to place the emphasis upon the hypnosis sessions, which could be questioned, and upon other speculative information instead of on the facts.
So they go out of their way again to discredit this couple and everything that they saw and witnessed, although they weren't in it for any kind of financial gain or concern. They didn't even want it to be public. They didn't want the embarrassment.
That's right. That's true.
So Stanton, why the need and overwhelming desire to destroy them? Is it because they were able to capture something that was so disturbing?
Well, yeah, I think so. Remember, we're dealing with two very respectable people. Not that the debunkers would point that out, but Betty was a social worker. Barney worked for the post office, but had also been appointed to the state Civil Rights Commission. Kathy was with them when they were invited to the inauguration of Lyndon Johnson. They were prominent people. And we haven't said so, but I suppose most people are aware. Barney was black, Betty was white, a mixed-race couple. In the early 1960s, it was rather an unusual deal. When they went to that inauguration, there were still miscegenation laws in Virginia. Blacks and whites couldn't mix in a bed, married or not.
Right.
Which they were. So times have changed. What I'm saying is the last thing they needed, they both worried about if anything got out about this, they'd lose their jobs. And you asked at the beginning, how did the story get public? And Kathy has told us in our book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And it was because somebody broke a confidence. Right, Kathy? I mean,
that is correct. Betty had a friend who lived down in Massachusetts. And this friend, Laurie D'Alessandro, had a lot of information about the case. Betty had confided in her about what she and Barney had said under hypnosis. And Laurie D'Alessandro just happened to speak to a reporter for the Boston Herald Traveler, John Luttrell. And John Luttrell had a real interest in this. He had contacted Betty and Barney and said that he wanted to write about their experience. They said, absolutely not. We refuse to talk to you. They had a reputation to protect because of the important work they were doing for the people in the state of New Hampshire. And the worst thing that could possibly happen is to be associated with a UFO abduction and to be thought of as a couple of kooks instead of the credible people that they really were. Well, unfortunately, after Laurie told John Luttrell about this, interviewed officers at Pease Air Force Base. He interviewed people in upstate New Hampshire who he said had observed the craft on the night that Betty and Barney saw it. It was in one of his articles in the Herald Traveler. And he did publish the story. It appeared for 5 nights in a row. Betty and Barney were frantic about it. And it really changed the course of their lives.
We're talking about all the disinformation and misinformation, how these groups and government agencies and debunkers will go to no end to try to disprove these stories, to mislead the public, mislead the government, mislead anybody to try to get these stories squashed and squelched. But yet they continue to happen on a regular basis. Stanton, we've heard stories like, what was it, 7-8 years ago when one of the largest airports in the United States, O'Hara Field, was shut down because something was hovering over O'Hara Field?
Yeah, there was a very good case, and it went up through the clouds, drilled a hole in the clouds, as somebody said, and there were very respectable airline-related people that saw that. And fortunately, there was a good reporter with the Chicago paper who covered the case, and his article about that front page got more attention than any article he'd ever written. And he got calls from all over the world about people wanting to interview him, the reporter. So when you play the story straight, the response is excellent. And I should say, I come on very strong in my lectures, more than 700 lectures, you know, all 50 states, 10 provinces, 18, soon to be 19 other countries. And I've had 11 hecklers, and two of them were drunk. And you get that many if you talk about sports, religion, politics,
right,
whatever. So I know the public is ready, willing, and able. But another part with regard to the Hill case and the people's attitudes, Carl Sagan used some of it in Cosmos, misrepresented the case, incidentally. And he also, in a Parade magazine article, a Sunday supplement, you know,
right,
he got the things wrong about the case. And we talked about it. We were classmates at the University of Chicago, and I had visited him, and we talked about that. But he also, as another example of the problem you have trying to treat the subject right, Carl, on two different occasions, and it's in two different books, said there are UFO reports which aren't reliable. There are reliable reports which aren't interesting. There are interesting reports which aren't reliable, et cetera. But there are no interesting and reliable reports. Well, the biggest study ever done for the Air Force, Carl gave no source material for that. The biggest study ever done for the Air Force showed the more reliable the sighting, as judged by four scientists at Patel Memorial Institute, Columbus, Ohio, the more reliable the sighting, the more likely to be unexplainable, the exact opposite of what Carl had said. And so comments like that, widespread from very highly respected people, and I give Carl credit for doing more than anybody else to get people interested in extraterrestrial life, but putting out misinformation and disinformation. Four rules for debunkers. Don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up.
Right.
What the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. If you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier. And do your research by proclamation. It's too much trouble to do investigation. And so we have to be cognizant of this. Fortunately, I believe the younger generation is being more reasonable about this. And I think the press coverage has actually improved the attitudes. There's an old thing that truth, new ideas come to be accepted, not because their opponents come to believe in them, but because their opponents die and a new generation grows up that's accustomed to them.
That's an excellent point.
Kathy and I did another book, Science Was Wrong, 14 chapters. We each did seven, each one stimulated by some smart scientist saying something stupid, like the great astronomer said if there was one thing he was certain of, man would never fly any distance in a vehicle. That was 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. And there are a whole bunch more examples of this. So it should not be surprising that a controversial, exciting new idea would be pilloried by people who don't bother to look at the facts. Look at Billy Mitchell. He was a pilot in World War One, and he made a big thing after the war that aviation would be extremely important in the future and would be used to sink ships. Secretary of the Navy said, "I'll stand on any ship he says is going to be sunk by a plane." In 1941, November 29th, there was the Army-Navy football game, and in the program for the game, it showed a picture of the USS Arizona, huge battleship.
Mm-hmm.
And text said, nobody's ever sunk a big ship from the sky. 8 days later, at Pearl Harbor, the USS Arizona was sunk by bombs dropped from the sky, killing 1,100 crew members who were on that ship. The Japanese knew you could build, you could sink a ship from the sky. So there are dangers in accepting comments from people who don't know what the heck they're talking about in the area that they're speaking. They may know about other things. And so that's one of the reasons for writing these books, was to make people aware that there are consequences. In other words, there were medical cures that were poo-pooed because, what was it, Kathy, that vaccinations would never stop smallpox?
Not only that, if you had a smallpox vaccination, then you, since it was made from the cowpox virus, killed virus, you would develop the characteristics of a cow. So you might grow horns, you might grow udders, you might end up behaving like a cow. So that was disseminated in order to convince people that they didn't need to do this because, of course, many doctors were making a lot of money in variolation clinics in Europe and in the United States, too, where they would infect people with a light dose of smallpox, and they would remain in their hospitals for a couple of months while they recovered. Because the poor people couldn't afford it. They were just disfigured or they died. But the doctors involved had personal financial reason for making fun of the cowpox vaccine. Even though it worked.
Well, sure. I mean, look, that continues today. What was it? Not even, I think, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the doctor that came forward and said ulcers are not caused by stress. They're caused by a bacterial infection, and we can treat them. And he got laughed out of the symposium. And now what do we know? That's the fact. And you'd started off the show earlier, Stanton, by mentioning that, you know, they'll say this doesn't exist. Science doesn't acknowledge this. You can't be a real scientist if you believe this. But science, if I'm correct, and please, I know you'll step in and let me know if I'm wrong. Science is predicated on the idea of taking leaps, making a theory, a hypothesis, and then trying to see if you can find substantial evidence to back that up. And if not, then it's put away and shelved. But you can't just say you can't be a scientist if you believe in ghosts or UFOs or Bigfoot. You have to question those aspects, because if you don't question it, you know, how would we have gotten penicillin? How would electricity work? How would any of this happen if we didn't take these large leaps of faith into what most people probably thought was insane talk at the time?
My mantra is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. You have to change how you do things. A laser isn't just a better light bulb. It produces light, but entirely different physics. And you have to look at all the uses of lasers, and it's less than 60 years since the laser was discovered. And there are a whole bunch of examples of this. And the people who put them forth initially often were ridiculed, denied, job promotions and stuff like that. Another medical one, Dr. Semmelweis in Vienna, delivering babies. There were big lying-in hospitals back then, and the women that were cared for by the midwives, fewer than 5% got childbed fever. The women that were delivered by doctors, medical doctors, 20% got childbed fever. And Dr. Semmelweis was very concerned about this, ran a bunch of experiments. It's a long story that's in the book. But he wound up putting up a new bunch of rules. The kicker was that doctors were doing autopsies upstairs and then coming down and examining women about to deliver without washing their hands.
Oh, good grief.
Believe it. And so he published papers, set up new rules, cut the percentage down from 20 to less than 5, and was fired for his troubles because the head of the hospital said, that's not the way we do things. So my point is, it's not only with regard to UFOs that people have behaved unprofessionally. How's that? That's a neat way of saying it. Nastily, stupidly, I could say as well. It's interesting to see how much disinformation, misinformation has been put out by the so-called scientific community. We go into a lot of it in the book about UFOs, and you still see people saying things about interstellar travel is impossible, or people estimating that the nearest other civilization would have to be thousands of light years away, when in fact, as I said earlier, there are 10,000 stars and about at least that many planets within a mere 100 light years. And it surprises many people when I point out that, you know, we're 4.3 light years from the next star over. However, there are plenty of stars that have another star less than a light year apart. And we mentioned the Hill case. There was a star map associated with that. We talk about this in the book. And to make a long story short, it appears that those guys, I presume they're guys, came from a planet around either Zeta 1 Reticuli or Zeta 2 Reticuli. That's the Greek letter Zeta, and it's the constellation of Reticulum, which means the net in Latin. The interesting thing is that not only that they're just 39.3 light years away, but those two stars from each other are less than an eighth of a light year apart. They're more than 30 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. From a planet around one looking at the other star, it's visible all day long. You could learn a heck of a lot about it because it's so close. It wouldn't be surprising if there were earlier interstellar travel when you got a next door neighbor. And you can tell a lot about what's going on the planets around that star than if you're many light years apart. But nobody wants to talk about that.
You have an interesting story, Kathleen. I'd like you to talk to us about in dealing with the Discovery Channel. Can you shed a little light on that for our listeners?
Yes, I'd be delighted. This is talked about in our chapter, A Hard Look at the Media. So we're talking about how we've been treated by the media as ufologists. And it wasn't long after Betty's death that I was asked to do a show on Discovery Canada. It was in 2006, and it was for the world's strangest UFO stories. I went up to the White Mountains of New Hampshire, and Stan Friedman met me there for the interview. I had taken a lot of evidence, the Air Force reports, Betty's dress that was damaged on the night of September 19 and into the early morning hours of the 20th, 1961, the pink powder, the laboratory analysis of all of this, lots of evidence for them to look at. And when I arrived, they seemed not to be very interested in the evidence. And then they asked me to sign a release. And I read every word in that release. I think it's always a good idea to do that. And I was shocked to see that I was supposed to give them permission to slander me. And I said absolutely no to that. But then,
what a killjoy you are, Kathleen.
Did that, and many months later, Stan got in touch with me, and he was really quite angry. And what had happened is that they had released an advertisement for their show, and they had titled it, I Had Sex with an Alien. And prominently displayed in the advertisement was Stan's image next to the show's title. To get to the segment itself, it asked, imagine for a moment that aliens really exist. What would they be like? Perhaps there was only one thing aliens can't get anywhere else in the universe. Have extraterrestrials traveled halfway across the limitless expanse of space? Because they have the hots for humans? Maybe they just want to have sex with us. And then they went on to misrepresent Betty and Barney, calling theirs the first experience, the close encounter of a sexual kind, talked about how they had stripped Barney down and taken an unusual interest in his genital organs, also how they had stripped Betty naked and had deeply probed her. And that is completely false. If you've ever read Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, you will know that that is absolutely untrue. But this was something, probably one of the worst and most slanderous yes. examples of misrepresentation of the Hill case.
I mean, using my picture, and I had sex with an alien, that, you know, I can laugh about it, but
right.
it's a perfect illustration of the irrationality of, you know, some of the media people who think what they needed sensational. On the same program, incidentally, they had a woman who talked about all her sexual adventures with aliens, and they had a guy and his sexual adventures with aliens. I mean, that's what UFOs are all about, right?
Right. Yeah, that's, well, sex sells. That's what they tell me, Stanton. In my house, sex just means I got a lot of kids to pay for college for. That's all it meant. You've got this, and right, I mean, that's the media at play, taking serious cases, taking serious stories that, if developed the right way, told the right way, and fact, just given fact, it is more intriguing than the nonsense they make up for most of these shows. But they're doing a disservice in reporting a lot of this because they twist it to play up whatever angle they think will be better or more, more popular with their viewers or readers or listeners.
One example to prove that the public is really interested is that last year, the International UFO Museum and Research Center in Roswell, New Mexico, was visited by 184,000 people.
Wow.
And Roswell is 200 miles from Albuquerque, 200 miles from Amarillo, 200 miles from El Paso. It's in the middle of nowhere. And families come with their kids and their dogs. That's a commitment. You know,
right.
It's not some place they're going through to get to someplace else because it's not on the way to anywhere. And it's a pleasure to deal with the people there. So many tell us that they've seen us on YouTube and in other programs. They want their picture taken. They're treating the subject quite in a friendly fashion. They didn't come to ridicule. They came to learn.
And it was nice to see so many young people and families together who had an interest in this topic.
And Stan, I know off air we were kind of discussing some of the silliness of what's going out there, some of the disinformation. You had some interesting points that led to nuclear fusion. Can you kind of expound upon that for us here on air so our listeners can be a part of it as well?
Well, yeah, I think it's safe to say that every civilization will wonder about what the heck is going on in their star. Just about all planets are circling around stars, and obviously they're getting their energy from the star, and making a little fire or forest fire or anything like that isn't going to give you that kind of energy. So what's going on? And it turns out we didn't realize what was going on until 1938, when a physicist decided that the sun was producing its energy by nuclear fusion. Now, you couldn't do that until you had discovered the neutron in 1932, and fission also in 1938. Fission and fusion, two different things. Everybody's heard E equals mc squared. Energy produced equals the mass times the square of the speed of light, which is a very large number indeed. And so atomic bombs use fission. H-bombs use fusion. And so who cares about bombs? Well, the kicker here is that I have worked on nuclear fission rockets. Three different outfits tested them successfully. The biggest was Los Alamos built a nuclear fission rocket that would cut triple your payload to Mars if you used it as an upper stage. Less than 8 feet in diameter, produced twice the power of Hoover Dam, which is considerably larger.
Wow.
That was fission. That was in the late 60s. Now, but it was obvious that fusion, which is what goes on in H-bombs, is the real power of the universe, because fusion is what goes on in all the stars, hundreds of billions of them. And what's special about fusion? Well, you can take the sequence. In 1944, a big bomb was a 10-ton blockbuster, 10 tons of dynamite it released the energy of. By 1945, our first atomic bomb, fission bomb, released the energy like 16,000 tons of dynamite. In 1952, our first fusion device, they called it Mike, and it was tested out in the Pacific. The fireball was 3 miles wide. And it released the energy, this one stinking bomb, of 10 million tons of dynamite.
Wow.
And a few years later, the Russians put up one, a big mama, if you will, 57 million tons of dynamite. That was how much energy was released by this one bomb. Now, why do I mention this? Because anybody thinking about it will realize that you can develop a propulsion system using fission or fusion. especially fusion. The nice thing is the stuff you use are isotopes of hydrogen, which just happens to be the most abundant and lightest element in the universe. Wherever you go, you're going to find hydrogen. So if you're smart enough and it's going to take a lot of dough, we can go. And so it makes some of these silly stories about, oh, they have to start from another galaxy. It would take 70,000 years to get here from the nearest star and all kinds of silly stuff. And
well, that's an assuming that they're coming from that's assuming they're coming from far ends of the galaxy and they haven't figured out a way to do that, right?
No, not far ends of the galaxy, just down the street in our local galactic neighborhood. Andromeda is 2 million light years away. Zeta Reticuli is 39. So I don't care about galaxies. Who cares? We got plenty of stars around here.
Do you think that all of the UFO activity that we're seeing, though, is it truly something that is from out there, outer space? Could it just be something that's closer? You know, we talk about dimensional portals. We talk about the possibilities that they're here or have been here. Or could a lot of what we're seeing exist on our planet and these aliens are among us at all times?
Well, I haven't met any aliens. Look, I am not saying all UFOs are alien spacecraft. Just like not all isotopes are fissionable. Some are. That's what matters. Not all chemicals cure disease. If you're sick, give me the one that does. I don't care about the ones that don't. So I'm saying a substantial number in Blue Book Special Report 14, 21.5% of the sightings were unidentifiable after substantial effort was made to identify them. So that's when it comes to fission, less than 1% of the uranium atoms in a hunk of uranium are fissionable. We try to build that up to over 70% if you want to build a bomb out of it. And we're willing to spend lots of money to do that. We built a facility in World War II that was a mile long to pump uranium hexafluoride gas through small holes, and the lighter atoms move a little faster. We were using 5% of all the electric power being produced in the United States during the war to separate isotopes of uranium. And when we tested our first bomb, we lied about it. So an ammunition dump blew up. Fortunately, nobody was injured. So the security was an important part of this. So I'm not saying everything that people see in the sky that they can't identify is an alien spacecraft. Of course not. That isn't the question. The question is, are any? And my answer is very definitely yes, when you look at the physical trace cases, the radar visual sightings, the abduction cases, etc. There's a ton of data that the debunkers never talk about. Just look at the SETI books. You don't find any references to the scientific UFO studies. It's as if they didn't exist.
So if you had to put a percentage on it, then what would you say the percentage would be?
Well, I'd say 20%.
About 20%? And that 20% you're convinced is, I guess I'd use the term local UFOs, not from the outer reaches of the galaxy, but...
Well, okay, local, sure. And within our local galactic neighborhood,
okay,
I'd say within 100 light years, there's 10,000 stars, so that's room enough.
And by saying local, I don't mean like... You get what I'm saying, Stanton. I'm not saying, I'm not saying, immediate local, but local as in being able to travel with that fission engine.
Better fusion. But
fusion engine, yes, yes.
Yeah, I don't think you need to warp space and time is what I'm saying.
With these other travelers, then, how do you hypothesize they're getting here?
Well, I think we got a two-stage system, a fusion device to get between the stars and the little Earth excursion modules, huge motherships, if you will. And little Earth excursion modules, I lean toward magneto-aerodynamics. It turns out, I had a literature search done of government reports in 1970, using that as a key word, magneto-aerodynamics. And much to my surprise, frankly, I got 900 references. 90% were classified. So a lot of people looking at plasmas around vehicles, if you will. I'm not saying I'll build you one in my backyard. Ain't going to come cheap. Nothing fancy does. You can buy a cheap digital wristwatch for a few bucks, but try to design the chip and manufacture the chip, and Intel spends $1 billion when they build a facility. So you got to be careful. I'm not saying it's easy.
Right. Absolutely. We got about a minute left here. Again, tell people where they can pick up the book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, The Truth Behind Misinformation, Distortion, and Derision by Debunkers, Government Agencies, and Conspiracy Con Men.
Kathy's website is one place.
Yes, on our website at StantonFriedman.com or Kathleen-Marden.com. Also, you could go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and they are available in many different formats there. But the good thing about going to our website is that you get our autographs.
Oh, there you
Both
go.
Both of our autographs.
There you go. We encourage you to do that as well. Kathleen Marden, Stanton Friedman, thank you very much for joining us on Darkness Radio tonight. We appreciate you.
Thanks for having us.
So there you have it, folks. That's the first of two memorial shows that we'll be doing this weekend in honor of the late, great Stanton Friedman. That's Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. Kathleen Marden, his co-author on that book. Go and get a copy of that book and honor Stanton in that way. Get into that book, read that book. That book came out about 3 years ago in 2016. And get a copy of it this weekend or even beginning of this next week. Page through it. Get to know it. Stanton had a lot of great knowledge to put out there for everybody, not just skeptics and believers, but all people who look to the skies and wonder if there's something out there. Stanton had a wealth of knowledge, and again, just knowledge that we should be sharing amongst ourselves, whether you're a novice or you're an expert. It's something that we all have something we can learn and should continue to learn from Stanton, even as he crosses over that veil and gets the truth about whether aliens exist or not. That's one of those things that I've been thinking about all week. And I'll refer to the late, great Art Bell. You know, it was said when Art passed, did Art really get to find out the secrets of the universe? And I thought to myself a couple of times this week, did Stanton get to know when he crossed over the truth about aliens? And whether there were alien races out there that were able to communicate? And did he get to find out what worlds they were on? And did he really get to find out all there is to know about these secrets of this universe? And was it all unveiled to him at that moment, or was it going to be spoon-fed to him little by little? And I'm wondering if Stanton has that wonderful smile on his face and is getting all the information as we speak, if he just dove headlong into it, or did he hang around to say goodbye to his loved ones and taking his sweet time and savoring the little bits of information as they came across? I wonder. I really do wonder. Stanton, we're going to miss you greatly. You have no idea, my friend. Join us again tomorrow, where we'll be airing another encore presentation of another program from Stanton Friedman as we continue to honor the legend in ufology, Stanton Friedman. For Dave Schrader, I'm Tim Dennis. We will see you again tomorrow in the best of Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Darkness Radio.